I think most of us
would like to be bigger than we are. I don't speak of that being physically. I mean more magnanimous. I think most of us would like to be able to go to somebody's house that's much nicer than ours and truly rejoice with them. I mean, truly be happy for them and express that. I think we'd like to go to people's houses that were smaller than ours and not feel superior. Wouldn't it be nice? Wouldn't it be nice to have such a largeness of spirit and heart that you could be the same in a palace as you are in a hut? That'd be great. I think we long for that. I think we want to be big people, but sometimes we get caught up in these petty things and we don't know what to say and we have these thoughts, you know, if it were my house. Yeah, right. And I guess the question is, how do we get that internal compass? How do we become those kinds of people? Rudyard Kipling, in his poem, If, one of my favorite poems, in fact, it's in my office, hung up. A friend of mine did a calligraphy for me years ago, makes this comment: if you can dream and not make dreams your master, if you can think and not make thoughts your aim, if you can meet with triumph and disaster and treat these two impostors just alike, isn't that good? If you can fail and succeed and, quite frankly, neither move you or change you, wow. If you can watch the things you gave your life to broken and stoop and build them up with worn-out tools, if you can talk with crowds and keep your virtue, if you can walk with kings and not lose your common touch, yours is the earth and everything in it, and what is more, you'll be a man, my son. Powerful words. I'd love to be like that. Wouldn't you? Love to be that kind of person. And yet my question to you is, how do we get it? And does Christianity simply offer that? In other words, does Christianity say, you know, you could become a person like this, like Paul, who said, I can have a little or I can have a lot, it doesn't matter. Does Christianity simply say, this is a great suggestion and it offers it and some of you will get it? Or does Christianity command it? In fact, does Christianity say anything less than that is paganism? Heathen and ungodly. What do you think? Available or commanded? Exodus says, thou shalt not covet. Paul puts it in the positive. I have learned in whatsoever state I am there to be content. Now, this is an audacious claim. Paul is in prison. He's locked up. The Philippian church sends him a gift, and here is Paul's response. Listen to Paul. We're not shocked by the scripture anymore. Paul's response is, look, I'm thankful for the gift, not because I need it. I'm thankful for the gift because it demonstrates your heart and your love for God. Because quite frankly, I can do without it. I mean, I've learned to have a little, I've learned to have a lot, I've learned to be good, I've learned to be bad. I've learned to have much and little, and quite frankly, it doesn't matter because I have Christ and I can do all things through Him. That's just ludicrous. I mean, come on, let's face it. If we sent a missionary a gift, and the missionary sent us a letter and said, I got your gift, and I'm so thankful for the gift. Oh, not because I need it, but because it demonstrates your love for Christ. Quite frankly, I can do without it because I've learned that Christ is sufficient. We'd cut their support, the twit. I mean, you know, a spiritual mumble jumble. Who do they think they are? Grovel and love the gift we sent you. I mean, wouldn't it? I mean, come on. We would have a meeting of the missions committee to discuss that missionary's problem. How dare they downplay our gift and say, I don't need it. I have Jesus. You know, Paul does this before Agrippa. Remember the scene? He's brought in chains and he's testifying for Christ. And Agrippa's a Jewish king and Festus is a Roman. What do I do with this raving lunatic? So they bring Paul in before Agrippa and he testifies of Christ. And Agrippa says, Paul, you almost persuade me to be a Christian. And Paul has the audacity in chains to say this, I would to God that not only you, but all who hear me today might become almost and altogether such as I am, except these chains. You don't get it, Agrippa. I want everybody to have what I have, to be just like me, except these chains. We wouldn't support Paul. Way too spiritual for us. We just kind of go, the audacity of that missionary. Now, here's my question once again. Is spiritual contentment, is satisfaction, is is this sense of fullness of Christ that causes us to handle both richness and poorness, success and failure the same way. Is that available to us? Is it something that you are to attain to and, you know, if you work really hard, you might get it? Or is it demanded by Christianity? Which is it? See, the audacity of Christianity is to command it. You will not covet. You know what the 10th commandment is? I finally got it. I mean, I've preached on this for years and thought, oh, the 10th commandment, I got to get through this so I can get on to something new. And I couldn't get it. I mean, it was just, what do you do with this? You know what I finally figured out? The 10th commandment is simply the first commandment reiterated. Thou shalt have no other gods. You will love nothing more than me. Yes, it's the bookends. I am your sufficiency. Love me and have nothing else. I will be your sufficiency. See, Paul is saying to us, you are commanded by God to come to a place where you have an inner satisfaction in Christ that causes you to face success and failure and treat two imposters just the same. Now, one of the problems, ladies and gentlemen, is that we live in a culture that promotes this. We are drowning in it. It's not that we Americans are more sinful than Haitians, for example. It's just that our culture promotes, I mean, we are told in seminars the way to be a great salesman is to covet more, and then you'll sell more. Most sales seminars are basically telling you if you get really greedy and lustful, you'll be a better salesperson. We use desires almost as a selling point. We live in an advertising world where the whole point of marketing is to get you to want more. Let me demonstrate this way. I've been told Eskimos have 11 words for snow. Why? Because snow is a huge part of their life, and they have 11 words to differentiate different kinds of snow. We don't have one modern word for covet. Not one. Why? It's not even part of the public debate. What do you need a word for? It's not on our radar screen. When was the last time you heard a discussion on TV among intellectuals, in your care group, anywhere, about coveting? Consumerism may be the closest we get, and that's just a recent word, because we're finally asking the question, do we have too much? Yeah, think? And it really isn't having too much, it's what we do with it, it's the desire for it. Okay, we'll talk more. So how do we distinguish between what is legitimate desires and what is coveting? What is the right thing to ask for? Legitimate, normal things we want that aren't necessarily coveting, and those things that really cross the border. And what's a good want and a bad want? And so let me try to define it for you. I came up with this definition. Coveting is an inner grasping for something that we think we need in order for our soul to be satisfied. Coveting is when you say, I have to have this to be happy. Coveting is when you want something and not getting it makes you miserable, anxious, and depressed. Coveting is when something becomes an idol and now you're a slave to it. You're no longer pursuing it, it's pursuing you. Coveting is when something becomes an addiction. You know what an addiction is? You know what an addiction is? An addiction? Addiction is an addiction because there's something you want that you think will satisfy and you've got to keep having more of this, more and more of it to be satisfied because it can't. And so coveting is an addiction when you say, I got to have more stuff or more things or more pleasure, and you find yourself now literally addicted. You have to have it to cover up the pain and the emptiness. On a positive level, Paul says that not being covetous means that you have a deep relationship with Christ that makes you content despite life circumstances. It means you never want anything more than Him. You never need anything more than Him. So how do we get there? How do we get there? Number one, there's a secret that must be learned. In verses 11 and 12, it says this. Philippians 4, 11 and 12. Not that I speak in regard to need, for I have learned in whatsoever state I am there to be content. I know how to be abased. I know how to abound. Everywhere in all things, I have learned to both be full and to be hungry, to be abound and to suffer need. I was curious this week because in the NIV and the NASV, in verse 12, it says, I have learned the secret to being content. And so I know some of you, you go crazy when you say translations have a little different, tweak. Don't go crazy. There are textual reasons. There are reasons why. And so I had to dust off my Greek New Testament from college and get some of those old books out and figure out what in the world is going on here. And I found out that the word in verse 11 for learning and the word in verse 12 for learning are two. Paul uses two different words. The word in verse 12 is a word that means literally to be initiated into. It was a word used of the initiation rites of the mystery religions. So Paul is saying, want and need and want and fullness have initiated me into this secret knowledge. I've discovered the secret to being content. What is that secret? Well, the key to that secret is the fact that he has learned both something from hunger and he has learned something from fullness. And here's the secret. The secret is that the things that I get in life cannot satisfy me. Rather, they arouse in me a desire for something more. The things that I get in life, whether I don't get them or I do get them, ultimately, that's not my satisfaction. My satisfaction is something more. Let me explain. When you're young, when you're teenagers, okay, and college age, this is what you think. If I can get to the right college and the right job and marry the right person, then I got it made in life. Isn't that how it works? Go to the right college, get the right job, marry the right person, means have the right kids, and I got it. It's easy street, baby. Once I get those things, I will be content and happy. I'll be fulfilled. Isn't that what you think? All of you 50-year-olds, you go, well, that's what you think. Yeah. And as you live that life and you get the right college and the right job and you get the house and you get the wife and you get the kids, at some point you go, what do you start thinking? Is this all there is? Is this all there is? Because something in my soul says, I want more. And the secret is realizing that this world is there to arouse in you a desire for something more. And it is the more that satisfies, not the world. Okay, can I illustrate this a different way? Why is it that the thing that brings me the greatest satisfaction in life also brings me the greatest pain? Why is it when you get the right wife, I mean the right one, that you can get more angry more quickly at her than anybody else in the world? Why is it that my biggest fights are with the people I love the most? Why? Because if you have a good relationship with your spouse, at some point you go, this is great, I want more. And you demand it. And when you don't get more from them, oh, does that make you angry? Well, the problem is you've made your wife a god and your wife can't be a god to you, sorry. But you see, a good relationship with your spouse is to cause you to go, Lord, this is great, but you know what? I want more. And that really comes from you, doesn't it? Help me to love you enough so I can keep nurturing my wife and not expecting her to be God to me because she can't be. And what if you have a difficult marriage? See, a difficult marriage is also going to cause you to say, Lord, I'm having a difficult time loving my spouse. But you know what? In my difficult marriage, I'm realizing that you are the ultimate satisfaction, so help me to find my satisfaction in you so I can love my spouse. Don't you see? Whether it's a good marriage or a bad marriage, it should point you to who? Christ. That's what Paul says. I found the success because I can have little or I can have a lot. It doesn't matter because a little points me to Christ. A lot points me to Christ. Don't you get it? If you have a great job and you really feel like you're contributing to mankind and you're doing, this is good because you're created by God to contribute and you're contributing and you have a great job, you're doing well. There comes a point in your life when you realize that no matter how good you do at this job, no matter how well, you will not get the respect you want. You will never feel like I've accomplished what I want to accomplish. Have you noticed that? Have you noticed that? Okay. Either this is a very uncomfortable sermon and you guys are not with me. And so what it ought to cause you to do, if the job is going well, you ought to go, Lord, this is great, but you know what? I want more. Ooh, that means I really need you, don't I? thank you for the job, but you know the greatest success I will have is being part of your plan, part of your kingdom, and someday being part of a plan that will not fail and where everything will be accomplished and be good. And I'm part of that, and that's my success, not this job. If the job's going poorly, then you say, Lord, it hurts me because I want to be more successful. I want to do better on earth. That helps me realize that ultimately my success is you. So it doesn't matter if you fail or succeed, as long as it points you to Jesus. That's the secret. Kids. We pour our lives into kids. And they leave. How dare they leave? We've invested a lot of our energy, our security, our value in them. You know, I was thinking, a perfect way to do this, we have kids for 5 years, somehow just kind of freeze them for a year, reconnect with your wife, 5 more years with the kids, reconnect with your wife. Wouldn't it be nice, every 5 years you get a year off from the kids to reconnect? No, we get 20 years and they walk out the door. Great. And there goes your value, your esteem, and then, this is why teenagers are difficult, because all of a sudden they're 14 and they know everything and they want to do it themselves, and you're like, wait a minute, I invested a lot of emotional energy in you, and you want to do it on your own, you might fail on it. If you fail, I fail. See what happens? We love them, we find great pain. If you make your kids your God, you will have incredible conflict with your kids. Because what you want from them, you will only get from Jesus. That value, that sense of belonging, that sense of accomplishment. That's the secret here. Paul says, I've learned this secret. I've learned it. Why? Because I've had a lot and I've had a little, and I've had to really wrestle with the fact that both ultimately point me to Jesus. There's a wonderful book by Sheldon Van Oken called Severe Mercy. Anybody read it? Oh, you've read it, yeah. My literature teacher has read it. Very good. Wonderful book. You all need to read Sheldon Van Oken's Severe Mercy. It is a book about a couple who have, humanly speaking, the most incredible, romantic, passionate relationship on earth. I mean, they are in love and they are really connected. I mean, they're just great, great relationship. But in this relationship, they become so enamored with love that they decide not to have kids because they're scared kids will interfere with their love. I mean, they really are connecting on a love. My wife read the book and she goes, "We don't have a relationship like that." And in my great maturity and wisdom, I said, "That isn't the point of the book." Maybe you shouldn't read the book. But anyway, as they got married and they had this great life, and she got cancer. She gets cancer and starts to die. And their lives are shattered. And as she's dying, Sheldon Van Oken begins to correspond with C.S. Lewis. And through his wife's sickness and through their correspondence, they come to know Christ, and she dies. And C.S. Lewis writes to him and says, "This is a severe mercy. God had to take away what you loved most in order for you to find the great love." Great book. Lewis is right. Sometimes God has to take away the things we love most to help us to realize that what we really want is something even greater. You see, "thou shalt not covet" is not this mean, "how dare you love anything else?" This is saying, "how dare you be satisfied with the little things when you could have everything?" Lewis once said, "we are like kids playing with mud pies when we could have the banquet." How dare you be satisfied with trinkets when you have treasure? It's a great principle. And Paul is saying to us, don't you get it? These things, whether it's success or failure, are there to give you a hunger for something much greater for Christ. Now, next question. How do we know if we're coveted or not? Pardon me, I keep taking a drink because I'm on this medication for my nose and it dries me out. So even my dry nose longs for heaven where I can breathe and all that good stuff. That's the way it should be. Fortunately, I just get grouchy. Next question. How do we know if we're covetousness or not? I mean, I don't want you to sit around going, because quite frankly, we are in the middle of it all. We are in a culture that just does not even talk about this, and it's going to be very difficult for you to see. One of my pieces of advice to you is to travel. Go to Haiti for a mission trip. You'll see it. You'll come back and go, oh my goodness, we are up to our eyeballs in it. And one of the ways that God is going to convict you of it is by two ways. By giving you everything you want, or by taking away things that are precious. Two ways he does it. This is why going to Haiti and experiencing some of their poverty makes you go, oh my goodness. Or when God takes something away from you of value. Or when he gives you everything you want and you realize that you have everything and yet you have what? Nothing. See, isn't that the way it works? Who are the people that are closest to coming to Christ? People who have great loss and people who have everything. You know what the problem with you and me is? We have just enough not to feel the pain, and we don't have enough to feel the emptiness. I'm worried about us. The middle class is the problem. So when God takes it away from you, that's when you find out. Do you love it? Or are you willing to say, yeah, it hurts, but I have you, so it's not a big loss. Or when you have everything, do you grasp it, or do you kind of hold it loosely and say, it's not a big deal, Lord. It just causes me to love you more. Isn't this the way it works in the Bible? Remember Job? I hope God never loves me as much as he loves Job. Really? Satan comes along and he says, have you considered Job? He loves me. And Satan said, he loves you because you do nice things for him. And God says, okay, take them all away. Please don't love me like that. But that really was love, wasn't it? Because Job found out. That down deep, even though he struggled down deep, he really did love God. Because he had nothing. And he said, you know, it doesn't matter. I have you. That's when you find out. The other way is when you have everything. There's a whole book in the Bible called Ecclesiastes. It is the testimony of a man named Solomon who got it all. And he said, it's all empty. I got everything. And it was nothing. And he says, remember now the day your Creator in the days of your youth. Don't do what I did. In fact, let me tell you a little secret. Christian people ought to enjoy life more than anybody else in the world. I am not preaching masochism to you. I am preaching the greatest pleasure. Give up the trinkets. Get the treasure. Because see, the treasures of these little trinkets on earth, they're trinkets. And they are to be enjoyed as love gifts from God, but they are to cause us to want more and to be able to say, this is a taste of your goodness. See, when you get food and you eat food and you go, oh, this was incredible food, it ought to cause you to go, Lord, thank you. This is a taste, a small taste of what it will be like to be at your table for eternity and to eat with you. See, we can enjoy the food, but we also enjoy the reality. When we have deep relationships with people and we have deep connections and we have passionate love in marriage, we ought to say, wow, what a taste of the passion that I will feel when I stand at my wedding day with you, my groom, oh Lord. That will be the ultimate love. But see, we love both. Because if you love this world as the ultimate love, it goes away. Vanity of vanity, says Solomon. And even when you're empty, you allow God to fill you. That's why Paul says, I found the secret. Whether I have nothing or I have a lot, it doesn't matter. Because really, ultimately, it's Christ. Danny Waits stood here not long ago. By the way, pray for Danny and Paige. They're in China, ministering there. We're excited about them. Danny Waits stands in front of you and me, and he says this. And you don't get it. I don't get it. Because we don't understand our own culture. He says, pray for the Chinese church. The thing the Chinese church fears more than anything is Western materialism. I mean, we sit there, we kind of go, huh? Excuse me? Because the Chinese church has nothing. And they depend for everything on God. And they're scared they're going to get enough where they can live like you and me. And I'm not mad at you, because I'm not sure I get it either. Every once in a while on a mission trip to a poor country, I get it. And I get over it way too fast when I get home. What does it mean to be able to live this way? Where you can say, I have something so much greater than this stuff that it doesn't matter. If God blesses me, so be it. I will use it for His glory. And if He takes it away, I will hunger and thirst for Him. It doesn't matter anymore. Wow. I want to get there. Can I say a few words to you if you're visiting with us? Maybe you're not religious. Maybe you don't come from a church background. Maybe we're glad you're here. Maybe you're a Christian who's struggling. May I say a few things? See, If you don't believe what I'm saying, you really got three choices, don't you? Okay, there's really three choices. Number one, you can say, I'm not happy because I haven't got enough yet. In other words, I can play the game harder. And if I work harder and have a little better job, a little bit switch wives, get a little better wife, get a little better house, a little bit more money, then I'll be happy. And a lot of people do that, right? You know, why is the divorce rate so high? It's because we if I covet my neighbor's wife and I get her, then I'll be happy. It's interesting that in the commandment, do not covet your neighbor's wife, do not covet your neighbor's house, do not covet your neighbor's things. John says there are three things that the world offers: lust of the flesh, lust of the eyes, pride of life. If I can have my neighbor's wife, see, if I just had her, or just had him, I'd be happy. Lust of the eye, I mean lust of the flesh. If I can have my neighbor's things, oh, if I had, you know, these things, then I'd be happy. Lust of the eyes. And my neighbor's house. See, a house is a status symbol, isn't it? That where you, the house is where you live. The neighborhood you live in determines your status. If I can just have a little more status, just be a little more important, lust of the pride of life. Amazing, isn't it? You can play the game harder, and you can think, if I just had a little more, then I'd be happy. That's one way to do it. A lot of people do it that way. John Wetzel showed me a book last year called The American Sucker by David Denby. Fascinating book. About a man who was a movie critic for the New Yorker magazine. I mean, this guy knows the parties. I mean, he is in the social light. He is a reporter for New Yorker magazine to the movie critics. I mean, he goes to all the premieres. He had the high life. And I believe he got divorced. His wife left him. Got divorced. His stocks went down because of the crash of the stock market. And he wrote this book called The American Sucker, where he said, what a sucker I was. I thought I had friends. I thought I had money. I thought I had prestige. I really had nothing. And it was incredible. He talked about greed and envy. I'm reading this book going, unbelievable honesty from a man who's not a Christian. And you're reading the book and you're going, oh man, he is this close to Jesus. Come on, buddy. And the last chapter he goes, oh well, I'll try harder next time. I was like, what? No. He said, if I can just get a house in the city, a house in the country, and $4 million, then I'll be happy. See, that's one of the ways you can do this, you know. You can say, if I just get more, I'll do better. If I just play better, play harder. That's one way. The other way is you can say, I don't care anymore. I quit. I'm not going to get it, and I don't care, and I quit. I'm sick and tired of it. You can be a cynic. You can paint your hair purple. You can pierce your body parts. You can walk out in public and go, yes, stare at me. I don't care anymore. I quit playing the game. People do that, don't they? In fact, we look at those people and we go, oh, they are so far from God. No, they're very close to God. Whew, they're this close. If we could just get them to realize the answer isn't, I don't care. The answer is, I care more than I can admit. And there's a place for my needs to be met. They'll come to Jesus. But people do that, don't they? They kind of become antisocial, drop out, do their own thing, or hermits, and they don't care anymore. They just don't care what you think. You see, in many ways, they're still playing the game, aren't they? They're playing defense. The other guy's playing offense. One guy says, if I can just get it. The other says, if I can just keep him wanting it. There's a third thing, a third way. And the third way is this. The third way is this. If I have desires, if I have needs that will never be met on this earth, maybe I was created for another world. If there are needs that cannot be met on this earth, maybe I was made for another world. C.S. Lewis, I love Lewis. He writes this: creatures are not born with desires unless satisfaction for those desires exists. Babies feel hungry, and there's such a thing as food. Ducklings want to swim. There's such a thing as water. We feel sexual desires. There's such a thing as sex. And if I find in myself desires and that no experience in this world can satisfy, the only probable explanation is I was made for a different world. And the earthly pleasures that I see were not designed to fulfill, but to arouse my desire for that place. Oh, you see what he said? If you're saying, I've done the American dream, and it's empty, maybe what you want is found in another place. Maybe what you want is found in Christ, and these things are simply steering your desires for that place. That's why Paul can say, thanks for the gift. Oh, it isn't the gift, it's your heart. Because quite frankly, whether I have a little or I have a lot, I'm content because I have Christ. What a way to be, huh? What a way to quit playing the game of life and to live above it and to have something that fulfills. And yet to be able to enjoy this life for what it is, something that stirs my taste for heaven. Well, how do we learn? How do we become that person? What's the process? Paul says, I have learned. There's a secret, but there's also a process. So let me just give you a couple of things, and then we're going to have a time of worship. I'm going to give you five things, and then we're going to have a time of a prayer, and a time of quiet reflection, and a time of worship. Because I want you to wrestle with these things. Okay, let me just give you five suggestions. Number one, if you're ever going to become this person, like Paul, you're going to have to call covetousness what it really is. You're going to have to get serious with this covetousness. I'm sorry. Covetousness, see, as you look at this drama, you can't just go, oh, I realize the first three responses probably aren't that big, but boy, it's so hard to be like the fourth. No, you need to look at this drama and you need to go, I am called to be like the fourth person. Anything less is unacceptable. See, somebody has said this. The 10th commandment is simply the first commandment in psychological terms. No other gods, you love nothing greater than me. He's right. And we have got to become serious with this commandment. We have got to be willing to say, Lord, it is not American. It is ungodly to want stuff more than you. It is wrong. And I have to repent and deal with it. I don't say that to be mean and condescending. I'm saying that to say, let go of the things that don't satisfy and long for what really does. But you won't have the real until you're serious about it. Until you see thou shalt not covet as being what it really is. Playing with trinkets when you ought to have the treasure. Secondly, we need to be preaching the gospel to ourselves. Preach the gospel to yourselves. What's the gospel? The gospel is that it is not my works of righteousness that satisfy God ultimately. No, it is He that satisfies my guilt and my righteousness. So that when you are at work and things are going well and you are getting praise, you preach the gospel. You say, thank you, Lord, for the privilege to represent you. But what I do is not what makes me right with you. What makes me right with you is the fact that you love me and I find my greatest satisfaction in you. That's the gospel. Because you need the gospel. And when you experience great pleasure in your relationships, say, Lord, as much as I love my children, and my wife, and my friends, nobody has ever died for me when I was a scumbag. But you did. And I will never be honored by anybody like that. Thank you for your goodness. That's what I need more than anything. And the other little things are taste of that. Thank you. Preach the gospel to yourself. Preach the gospel. Thirdly, one writer called it this, beware of the icing. Beware of the icing. You know, icing is good. You know that? One problem with icing, you can't live on it. Right? Live on icing, you get all kinds of problems. The world pleasures are icing. Jesus is the cake. And you have to be aware of the icing because you know what happens? We have a lot of, it's a sad world we live in. It's a difficult world. It's a stressful world. And we have these needs to be comforted, these needs to be free of guilt, and these needs to be loved. And you know what? There's a lot of icing that can fill those needs. When you're feeling sad, what really can fill that need just wonderfully? Huh? Food. You got it. When you know, when you're sad, isn't food just hit the spot? I'm sad. Boy, a good meal can fix my sadness. In fact, look, some of you folks out there are eating. You eat just to live. When I eat, it's an act of worship. Oh, yes. Now, who it's an act of worship for depends. There are days when I eat and I truly say, Lord, thank you for a taste of heaven. I love you. Other days I eat because my belly wants it and there's no God involved in this at all. But I'm discovering in my own life, a lot of times when I'm sad, I eat. And there's some times when we are sad and we go for the icing when we need to just stop and go, no, I'm not going to eat the icing today. I'm going to sit here and I'm going to meditate and I'm going to open my Bible and I'm going to get the cake. See, you know what fasting is? Fasting is when you give up the icing in order to have the real. Fasting is when you say, no, I'm sad right now. I need to be comforted, but that's icing, and I'm going to sit here and I'm going to give up the meal because I want to be comforted with the kind of comfort that only God can give. And so you don't eat the meal because you're saying, this is white bread. I want the rich manna from heaven. Fasting is when you say, you know, I could buy this and it would make me happy, but I'm not going to buy it. I'm going to go home and spend some time with the Lord and find a satisfaction that that will never give me. Oh, it's not wrong to buy it. But it's icing, and I'm going to beware of the icing because I don't need it. Beware of the icing. We have a world full of icing. I mean, you can just go to movies, entertainment, and food, and pleasure, and you never have to even deal with Jesus. But it's all icing, folks. It will kill you. There needs to be times in your life when you put the icing aside and really thirst for the rich, deep, dark manna that comes only from Christ. Number four goes with this, and that is we need to learn to commune with God. My elders and I Monday night met up here for worship and prayer, and I shared with my elders my concern that about 3 months ago somebody took a key and just cranked life up about, you know, double speed. And it seems like everybody I know in our church, our elders, our leadership, everybody's life's going nuts. Jobs and family, and it's just crazy. My concern is there's never a time in your life when you're quiet, where you're still, where God can speak, where you can commune, where your soul can be filled with something that isn't icing. Where you walk away and you go, I have a richness now, an internal richness that really lets me stand with Paul and say, you know what? Nothing else matters more than him. Boy, that comes to me in those deep moments of meditation. It doesn't come to me eating icing. You need to commune with God. And then last of all, you need a clear conscience. You can't lust for God and love for God and have a passion with God if there's sin. You just can't do it. You got to be willing to confess and come clean. David said, my sin has hidden you from me. You got to have a clear conscience. You know, Paul in this passage says, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. Then in verse 19, he says, my God shall supply all of your needs according to his riches in Christ Jesus. Isn't that something? Now listen to me. We're done. Listen to me. Jesus on the cross lost what meant most to him. Jesus on the cross gave up his fellowship with his Father. Jesus on the cross screams as he takes your sin and my sin, and he says for the first time in eternity, my God, why did you forsake me? Jesus is forsaken that you and I will never be forsaken. Jesus loses everything so that we can have everything. Jesus is cut off so you will never be cut off. Now, do you think that Jesus is playing games with us? Do you think he's not committed to our happiness and to our joy? Do you think he will not fill you with all fullness? Do you think he's toying with us? I don't think so. He paid the price that you and I might find in him a satisfaction, a richness, a freedom from guilt, a freedom from shame, and a joy that surpasses everything. He's not playing games. But ladies and gentlemen, here's the issue, and this is the bottom line. The issue is this. The issue is not, can we trust him? The issue is, can we stop trusting ourselves? The issue is not, can we trust him? Of course we can. The issue is, can you let go and quit trusting yourself? And that's what I'm saying. No other gods. You can trust him. Thou shalt not covet. Let go. Quit grasping for things that will never satisfy. Can you stop trusting yourself? The day you die to self is the day that you can really embrace Christ. Let's pray. Father, this is such a difficult concept for us. And it's not because we Americans are not like everybody else in the world. It's a difficult concept that we live in a culture that promotes covetousness. We're swimming in it. We have so much that we rarely feel pain. We have more icing available to us that fills our belly. At the same time, it just rots us from the inside out. Help us, Lord, to see our condition. Help us to long for the true joy. Help us to quit trusting our trinkets and the icing and thirst for the bread of heaven that is rich and deep and nutritious and fills and causes us to experience great joy. Help us to be like Paul so we can say, Lord, I can go through life, and whether I'm given a little or a lot, quite frankly, it doesn't matter, because I am consumed by Jesus Christ and I love him and he supplies all of my needs and I have this inner strength. Father, would you help us to wrestle now with what will have to take place for us to have that assurance. Father, you have commanded it. With your command goes your power. Meet with us now as we wrestle with you as your people.